Welcome to The Point. I'm Indy Todd. Later in the hour, we discuss a new exhibition at the Cultural Center of Cape Cod titled Unfinished Democracy, Artistic Reflections. The exhibit confronts the turbulent state of democracy as the nation braces for a divisive presidential election and numerous contentious races in Barnstable County. But first, our guest today contends America is undergoing a massive experiment. It is moving toward a multiracial democracy, but the prospect of change has sparked authoritarian backlash that threatens the very foundation of our political system. Why is democracy under assault here and not other wealthy, diversifying nations? And what can we do about it? Stephen Levitsky is co-author with Daniel Ziblatt, Tyranny of the Minority, Why American Democracy Reached the Breaking Point. Both are professors of government at Harvard University and the authors of How Democracies Die. Stephen Levitsky, welcome.
Thanks, Mindy. It's a pleasure to be here.
So Tyranny of the Minority is a call to reform our politics. You say we're at a crossroads and America will either become a multiracial democracy or cease to be a democracy at all. Can you just describe what a multiracial democracy looks like and where we're at in that process?
Sure. A multiracial democracy, really quite simply, is a democracy in any multi-ethnic or multiracial society. It's a democracy in which individuals of every ethnic group enjoy the same basic rights as others, not just on paper, but in practice, which means that the government, the law, the official authorities have to treat individuals of every ethnic group equally. So the United States was not even on paper a multiracial democracy until 1964-65, with passage of the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act. That established a multiracial democracy on paper. But in practice, although we contend in the book that we've been slowly but steadily marching toward a truly multiracial democracy over the last half century, there are areas where it's still we're not quite there. The fact that non-white voters in low-income districts tend to wait in much longer lines to vote and face more obstacles to register to vote than I do in Brookline, Massachusetts, is one indicator. Another is that the police do not, clearly evidence suggests that the police do not treat members of all ethnic groups equally when it comes to being searched, being arrested. Even the length of prison terms varies by race. So although we have come a long way, we spend some time in the book describing the progress that the United States has made since the 1960s towards multiracial democracy, one could argue we're not quite there yet.
Yeah. How about representation in Congress?
Representation in Congress has changed a tremendous amount since my bar mitzvah in 1981. So in my adult lifetime, the number, let me make sure I get this data right. Since my bar mitzvah, the number of Black and Latino members of Congress has more than quadrupled from 28 in 1980 to 114 today. For the first time in the history of the Republic, the percentage of African Americans in the U.S. Congress is now equal to the percentage of African Americans in the overall population, which means that African Americans, for the first time ever, are not underrepresented in the U.S. Congress. That is a sign of movement towards multiracial democracy.
You and your co-author have studied violent insurrections and efforts to overturn elections across the globe, but never imagined that you would see it here. So talk a little bit about the insurrection on January 6th, how that impacted. Was that influence you to write this book, or was the book in the works before that?
The book was in the works before that, but it powerfully shaped how we went about writing the book. We have an entire chapter, I think, that was rewritten in the aftermath of that, because you're right. I mean, we had written the book, How Democracies Die. We had been very clear that we thought U.S. democracy was under threat, but I think neither of us imagined watching the scenes that we watched in January of 2021. I don't think I ever imagined a president actively attempting to overturn an election and prevent a peaceful transfer of power. So we went back and we did some research on other similar events. One that we spent a fair amount of time on was an uprising in outside the French Parliament, effort to storm the French Parliament in 1934. And we became convinced that what's as bad as those events are, what really matters for the health of a democracy is how our political leaders respond. And when a country's political leaders from across the political spectrum, from all the parties, are joint forces and are clear in denouncing this kind of violence as undemocratic and unacceptable, an event like January 6th can help to sort of reconsolidate or reestablish democracy. We looked at the coup attempt in Spain in 1981 when soldiers stormed and took over the parliament building for 24 hours and tried to force a new prime minister. And the entire political spectrum, from the communists on the left to the pro-Franco right, joined forces in opposing, denouncing, mobilizing against this coup. And that was crucial. Spain never experienced another coup and has been a solid democracy for the last 45 years. In France, it was different. In France, elements of the right condoned, even supported the behavior of the rioters, protected them from prosecution. And so there was never a consensus in society or in the polity around the need to preserve democracy. And that's not the only reason why French democracy died. Obviously, the Nazis had a lot to do with it, but a lot of the politicians who flirted with the insurrectionists in France ended up in the Vichy government, ended up welcoming the Nazis and helping the Nazis rule.
Talk about the differences between a loyal Democrat and a semi-loyal Democrat. And this is D as in democracy, not the Democratic Party. So tell us a little bit
Right,
about
right,
that.
right. Very important. It's easy in the written word to separate that loyal small D Democrats and loyal large D Democrats. Here, I'm just talking about commitment to democracy. This comes from the Spanish political scientist Juan Linz, who was one of the great scholars of democracy and authoritarianism in the 20th century. He distinguished between loyal Democrats and semi-loyal Democrats. And we all, people who are disloyal Democrats, are easy to spot, right? These are the generals who seize power or people who take up arms against the government, openly authoritarian figures. But semi-loyal Democrats look a lot like loyal Democrats. They dress like them, they talk like them, they act like them most of the time. They could be sitting in Congress just 3 feet from you and you wouldn't know. The only way you can tell a semi-loyal Democrat from a committed Democrat is how they behave when an anti-democratic threat emerges in their own camp, on their own side. It's very easy, very, very easy to denounce authoritarianism on the other side of the aisle, right? They're fascists or they're the communists. But when an authoritarian emerges in your camp, what do you do? Loyal Democrats, politicians who are committed to democracy, will publicly denounce anti-democratic behavior, even among their own allies. They will seek to expel from the party anti-democratic elements, and they wash their hands. They break all ties with anti-democratic forces. This is Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger in response to Trump. Semi-loyal Democrats do none of those things. Oh, the other thing is that loyal Democrats do is they are willing to work with politicians from across the aisle, from across the political spectrum, to isolate and defeat the authoritarian. So they will work with the other side to defend democracy. Semi-loyal Democrats do not do those things. They will tolerate, accommodate, often condone, and sometimes even support anti-democratic elements. They refuse to expel them. They sometimes protect them, even nominate them. And even when democracy is on the line, even when democracy is threatened, they refuse to work with the opposition party to defend democracy. And we looked at the emergence of the very costly behavior of semi-loyal Democrats in France in the 1930s and how that led to a terrible, terrible outcome. And we're very disturbed to find that semi-loyalty became pervasive in the Republican Party in after 2016. The role that leaders like Mitch McConnell and Kevin McCarthy, for example, they weren't trying to kill democracy. They're not authoritarians. But their behavior enabled Trump's rule. Their refusal to break with Trump, their willingness to occasionally protect Trump, and really the entire Republican Party's willingness to accommodate and occasionally protect Trump was critical to his success. And that's a really bad sign. Looking at Democratic breakdowns in Europe in the 1930s, in Latin America in the 60s and 70s, when mainstream political parties of the center left or the center right begin to tolerate, accommodate, flirt with extremists on the far left or the far right, that's when democracy gets into trouble. And that's what we see happening here.
We're talking with Stephen Levitsky, co-author with Daniel Ziblatt of Tyranny of the Minority: Why American Democracy Reached the Breaking Point. We'll have more after a break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Stephen Levitsky, co-author of Tyranny of the Minority: Why American Democracy Reached the Breaking Point. In the book, you write, the threat facing American democracy was never simply a strongman with a cult-like following. The problems are more endemic than that. In fact, they are deeply rooted in our politics. Until we address those underlying problems, our democracy will remain vulnerable. Give us some examples. The Constitution is one, right? I mean, where we need change.
Yeah. So there, I guess, two answers to that question. One is what we were just talking about, which is that unfortunately, the Republican Party from top to bottom has become a party that is no longer committed to democratic rules of the game. And so a reform of the Republican Party is that's sort of the most urgent matter. The Constitution, although a brilliant document that has served us well in many, many ways, is exacerbating the problem today because it protects and empowers what has become an authoritarian minority. MAGA and Trump have never enjoyed majority support in the United States. Not for one day has Trump or MAGA had a public approval above 50%. Donald Trump did not win, has never won the popular vote ever in the United States, and is very unlikely to win in 2024. But our institutions are giving MAGA a leg up. We have a, I think there's really good evidence that in the 21st century, for the first time, we have in this country a multiracial democratic, small d democratic majority, meaning a majority of Americans, a solid majority of Americans, for the first time, embrace the core principles of multiracial democracy. They embrace diversity and they embrace true racial equality. You see this in the fact that there are now much stronger societal reactions against highly publicized acts of racism, Black Lives Matter, for example. You see this in the fact that more than 60% of Americans consistently tell surveys that the growing diversity of this country makes America a better country. You see it in the fact that more than 60% of Americans agree that our public schools should be teaching about America's history of racism, even if it makes kids uncomfortable. There are solid majorities behind these positions, but that majority is finding itself thwarted in many cases by our institutions.
Electoral college being one.
Electoral college is the most obvious. We are the only presidential democracy on earth where the loser of a presidential election can win the presidency. That's happened twice in the 21st century, and there's a very good chance it will happen again in 2024. The US Senate, which gives equal representation to all states, regardless of the number of people who live in those states, is a highly, highly undemocratic body in any self-respecting democracy, senators should represent people, not land. That's what democracy is. It's ruled by the people, not ruled by the mountain range or the land. The Senate filibuster makes the United States the only established democracy in the world where legislative minorities can systematically and permanently thwart legislation backed by majorities. That's minority rule.
And you say politicians routinely exploit gaps in the rules that often weaken democracy. And one example you give in the book is the Senate's 2016 refusal to allow President Obama to appoint a new Supreme Court justice.
Right, that's another sign of democratic weakening, which we spend, I think, more time on in How Democracies Die, which is when politics get highly polarized and when political parties begin to turn away from democracy, they begin to abandon the norms that are critical to sustaining a democracy. They begin to take a win at any cost, or sort of by any means necessary approach to politics. And any institution, any rule can be abused. In effect, one can use the letter of the law in ways that subvert the spirit of the law. And yeah, the refusal, I mean, it was entirely constitutional for Mitch McConnell to just flat out refuse to even take up Barack Obama's nominee Merrick Garland to replace to fill the vacancy created by Scalia's death, but it was clearly at odds with the spirit of our Constitution. Throughout our history, sitting presidents have been able to name to fill Supreme Court vacancies, and that basic norm was abandoned in 2016.
I think people get nervous. They say, like, what changed the Constitution? But we've done that before. And I thought this was interesting, a note that you have made that I did not realize. But George Washington himself said this was an imperfect document and up to future generations to fix it.
Yeah, and the fact of the matter is, future generations have worked to make our system more democratic, whether it's the Bill of Rights just 2 years after Washington wrote that letter, to the gradual expansion, at least of white male suffrage in the early 19th century, to the very important Reconstruction era reforms, to the extension of suffrage to women, to the very important Progressive era reforms, to the civil rights reforms. Really, generation after generation of Americans did work to make our system more democratic, and then, for reasons that I don't fully understand, we stopped in the mid-1970s. After the failure of the Equal Rights Amendment, we just stopped. And it's difficult to find any significant movement in the last half century to democratize our democracy.
You give so many great examples and into a lot of the history, and you'd think we would learn from some of this history that you point out in the book. So why do you think this is happening now?
Why the stall?
Well, yeah, why are we seeing a democracy threatened now? Why now?
What my take on it is, I mean, so the imminent cause, the most straightforward cause, is the transformation of the Republican Party. This is a mainstream center-right political party that's been around for a century and a half, competing peacefully in elections, that suddenly, over the course of the last decade, has abandoned the democratic rules of the game. Accepting the results of elections, win or lose, is the cardinal rule of democracy. It was not just Donald Trump who refused to publicly accept the results of the elections. A never Trump Republican group called the Republican Accountability Project evaluated the public statements of every sitting Republican member of Congress, Senate and House, in the aftermath of the 2020 election to see whether they raised doubts about the legitimacy of the election. 86% of them made public statements that raised doubts about the legitimacy of the election. So this is the entire party. So that's the principal goal. When you have in a two-party system, one party that is not committed to playing by democratic rules of the game, your democracy is going to be imperiled. So the question is, why has the Republican Party changed in this way? And we argue that it is a product of this extraordinary transition that the United States is going through from a in which a long dominant ethnic minority, excuse me, long dominant ethnic majority is losing not only its numerical majority, but its dominant status. This transition to a truly multiracial democracy in which white Christians do not sit at the top of social, economic, cultural hierarchies, political hierarchies, it has generated a hell of a reaction. There are many MAGA voters, not all of them, but many Trump voters feel like they're losing their country. They feel like the country they grew up in is being taken away from them. And that's had a radicalizing effect. There was a survey sponsored by the American Enterprise Institute, I think 3 years ago, that found that that 56% of Republican voters agree with the statement that the American way of life is changing so fast that we may have to use force to stop it. 56%. So our argument is that it is the dramatic changes in our society and culture over the last 50 years, and movement towards a much more egalitarian society in terms of race and gender and sexual orientation, has triggered an intense reaction among a minority of Americans, but a minority of Americans that is empowered by our institutions and occasionally has had a chance to rule.
There's a chapter in the book, It Has Happened Here, which looks at Wilmington, North Carolina in the late 1890s. I found this fascinating. They were well on their way to being a multiracial democracy. And this is exactly what happened, that threat, right? And I think I'm going to read here. It says, as one Democratic leader acknowledged at a rally, we cannot outnumber Negroes. And so we must either out cheat, out count, or out shoot them. That sounds outrageous, but
that's
what
exactly what they
happened,
did.
right?
That's what they did. Yeah, through outright terrorism, what today we would call terrorism, and outright election fraud. So there was a dramatic and almost overnight expansion of suffrage in throughout the U.S. South during Reconstruction, in the handful of years, in the 5 years after the Civil War. African Americans represented either an outright majority or a near majority in every Southern state. So the enfranchisement of African Americans was going to dramatically change politics. It was going to threaten the Democratic Party's electoral dominance, but it was going to threaten the entire racial hierarchy. And in fact, you saw African Americans getting elected to legislatures, in one case to lieutenant governor, to positions of power throughout much of the South in the early Reconstruction period, 1867, 68, 69. And there was an intense reaction against it. And entirely, we tend to downplay or ignore this as a part of our history because we like to think of ourselves as an old democracy. But this was openly authoritarian behavior, coups, violent seizures of power, stolen elections, preventing African Americans from voting at gunpoint, killing them for trying to vote. And so through illegal and even terrorist means, Southern Democrats seized power across the South and effectively stripped the right to vote from half the population of the South. And the U.S. South was effectively authoritarian for about 80 years.
You touched on this on the popular vote. Talk a little bit about the importance of the majority vote, because I think a lot of people go, hey, what happened? The majority of people voted for this candidate, and that's not the candidate who's taking the White House.
Well, in democracies, we tend democracy is obviously more than majority rule. A modern democracy has to protect basic minority rights. Not everything can be up for grabs in elections. Majorities are not entitled to enslave minorities. They're not entitled to violate the basic rights of minorities. So democracy is not shouldn't be equated with majority rule. But majority rule is an important part of democracy. The party that wins the most votes should win public office, and a government that are elected or parties that are elected with electoral majorities should be able to govern. And that is the case in most democracies in the world. If you travel to other established democracies, whether it's in Latin America or Western Europe or just north of us in Canada or New Zealand, Australia, Korea, Taiwan, majorities effectively rule. Those who win the most votes win elections and are able to govern. And the United States, more than any other democracy in the world, allows partisan minorities sometimes to win outright, as in the case of the Electoral College and the Senate. But other times to thwart the will of majorities. Consider this real quickly. In 2016, the loser of the presidential vote wins the presidency. At the same time, 2016, the party that won fewer votes for the Senate won control of the Senate. That president and that Senate went on to appoint and confirm three Supreme Court justices, dramatically shifting it to the right. If the United States had a system in which majorities actually won elections, won public office, like in most other democracies, the US Supreme Court would have a 6-3 liberal majority today. That is how out of whack our system is. And of course, you can think of numerous rulings of the Supreme Court in recent years where this has been very, very consequential.
Yeah. You write, previous efforts to build a multiracial democracy in America have failed. Unlike earlier periods, however, today's experiment has the support of most Americans. It is only in the 21st century that a solid majority has embraced the principles of diversity and racial equity. So either America will be a multiracial democracy, or you say it will not be a democracy at all. What is your biggest fear?
My biggest fear is an entrenchment of minority rule because minority rule can feed on itself. So I just gave the example of the loser of the presidential election winning the presidency, the loser of the popular vote for Senate winning control of the Senate and dramatically shifting the court. That Supreme Court has then gone on to reinforce the power of this authoritarian minority. It is permitted gerrymandering. It is not only slowed down and possibly derailed the legal proceedings against Donald Trump. It's protected him, but it is ruled in a pretty outrageous ruling that the president cannot be held legally accountable for anything he does in official acts as president. And so minority power begets power. And if an authoritarian minority is able to grab onto power, it can then use these counter-majoritarian institutions to entrench itself. And that's not a certainty. There still are important democratic elements in our system, and a very powerful opposition to these authoritarian forces. But our institutions give this MAGA minority, 35, 40% of the population at most, a powerful leg up and potentially give them the tools to entrench themselves in power, to seriously tilt the playing field against the majority.
And then on the opposite, are you optimistic that democracy will be saved?
Well, it's very hard to look into the future, and political scientists are really bad at predicting the future. I could give you a long list of my failed predictions. But my perception is following. I think we're in the middle of this transition to a truly multiracial democracy. We're in the middle of the reaction against it. That reaction has been much more fierce than most of us, certainly me, anticipated. I think we're going to be in a rough period for a period of time. It may be 5 years, it may be 10 years, it may be 20 years. I think we're in the middle of a period of serious democratic instability where we kind of lurch from crisis to crisis. And we may slide from dysfunctional democracy into a period of weak authoritarianism and then back. But I think we're headed in the short to medium run for a stormy period. I am, however, pretty confident that we're going to come out of the other end. Again, I don't know exactly when, as the world's first truly multiracial democracy, something we can be very proud of. We have a for all of our weaknesses as a society, we have a long history of dealing with diversity, with incorporating, integrating various immigrant groups. We have very strong institutions. And if you look at public opinion among younger Americans, millennials and Gen Z, they are far and away the generations that are most comfortable with diversity, living under diversity. And I think, you know, the older generations, I'm 55, my generation upward, this has been a struggle. But I think younger generations they are themselves more multiracial, and they're much more tolerant and accepting of the basic elements of multiracial democracy. So I think there's good reason, given the strength of our institutions, given our long history of integrating diverse communities into our society, and given the political attitudes of young people, I think within a generation we're going to be a what I hope will be a model multiracial democracy for the world.
Stephen Levitsky is co-author of Tyranny of the Minority. He's going to be the speaker at the Cape Cod Speaker Series on October 17th at Cape Cod Community College. We'll have a link with more info about that and the book at our website, capeandislands.org. Stephen Levitsky, thanks so much for joining us, and thanks for writing the books.
Thanks for having me. It was a pleasure.
Coming up after a break, we discuss a new exhibition at the Cultural Center of Cape Cod titled Unfinished Democracy, Artistic Reflection. The exhibit confronts the turbulent state of democracy as the nation braces for a divisive presidential election and numerous contentious races in Barnstable County.